All right, so welcome everybody. So this is an event that we organized with the opportunity of the publication of a new book on the Greek economy. So this is a collective effort by a bunch of people. I will tell you more about it later. So the people who will talk in this event will be the three of the four editors of the book. So Nikos, Vetas, Kostas, Megir, and I. Chris Pissarides is the other editor, and unfortunately he was unwell today and could not come. Then we'll have two discussants, Ricardo Ries and Yannis Manuelidis. And then we'll have a discussion that will be run by Hugo Dixon. So we'll plan to finish at around 8 o'clock. So let me also say, in terms of logistics, that there will be a reception afterwards at the senior dining room at the LSE, so just a building very close to here, to which you're welcome to come. And then also there are copies of the book are outside, and they are sold actually at a significant discount if you are interested to get the book. So, okay, so let me start. We'll start with a presentation shared by Kostas, Nikos, and me. And I will give an introduction to this presentation. First of all, a historical overview of the Greek economy and of motivating the kinds of things that we're going to tell you about later in this presentation. So this is a very important picture. It shows the GDP per capita of Greece and a few other countries from 1970 onward. So this picture shows two things as far as Greece is concerned. First of all, that Greece is gradually kind of stagnating and is kind of gradually becoming one of the poorest countries in the EU. So in 1980, it was 14th between 28 countries. And it slid gradually over time to 24th in 2016. And this is in terms of purchasing power parity. So some of, if we don't adjust, so in other words, adjusting by purchasing power of the inhabitants of the country. So the other important point is that this fall has been gradual, has been actually a fairly slow process. It's not just about the euro, or it has, for example, Spain and Ireland overtook Greece in the mid-80s. So so we really want to think about, and kind of this what we'll talk about a lot today, is kind of the underlying causes of this relative stagnation. So let's just a few other graphs that kind of highlight some long-term trends. One is investment, and this is corporate investment as a percent of GDP. So the picture shows that a few things, again, comparing Greece with Spain, Portugal, and the EU average, is that corporate investment in Greece has been lower than, kind of chronically lower than in the other countries. And however, in the run-up to euro entry, it rose quite a bit in the anticipation that Greece was going to join the euro. But then again, it dropped very significantly during the crisis. We will come back to that issue later. The other thing, and this relates to investment, the behavior of investment, concerns the business environment, that the business environment has kind of not been very attractive. If comparing, for example, these are the World Bank doing business report rankings, so which are available from 2005 onwards. So comparing Greece to Ireland, Spain, Portugal, Germany, Greece has been worse, significantly worse, although there has been a significant improvement during the crisis from 2010 to 2012, 14. From then on, things stabilized. So there is a problem about the business environment, and this is kind of a purely an institutional issue. And this is consistent with another indicator of this business environment, or something that relates to business environment, is the level of foreign direct investment. So even during the time that Greece was growing fast, from 2001 to 2007, so before the crisis hit, FDI in Greece was 1% of GDP, while in the EU average it was 4.5% of GDP. And Greece was the last in the EU, even though it was in a growing economy and labor costs were not particularly high relative to the EU average. Things, kind of the picture is also the same, is also similar during the crisis. But the foreign direct investment is important because foreign companies are kind of more subject to the kind of institutional problems, barriers to entry, and other things that we're going to talk about later today. So this is a good indicator of business environment. Then another institutional aspect that is worth highlighting, that it is not about business environment, something fairly that we think is fairly dissociated from the business environment, It's about the extent of social protection. So it's not just that there has been a problem with making the country attractive for people to run to open and run businesses, but it's also about having an appropriate protection net. So, for example, the poverty rate in Greece has been actually quite high, even before the crisis and the rising, comparable to Spain and to some extent to Portugal, while Ireland, for example, that has a much better business environment, has had a significantly also lower poverty rate. And same for Germany. So there is a general issue, and this brings me to the next point, which is about kind of the role of the institutional aspects. So, and the view that we're going to take in this presentation, we take in our book, is that the stagnation of the Greek economy since the 80s is a long-term phenomenon. It's not just about the euro or a kind of macro factors, but it's something that is due to kind of micro-level institutional problems. So the fact that the government debt has been rising all the way helped somehow cover the problems. Now, what happened in the run-up to euro and after to euro entry, the fast growth and the sharp contraction during the crisis, we view this as a shorter-term phenomenon. This is also due to macro reasons. But this should not kind of change the broader picture, that the particular GDP per capita in Greece in real terms is the same as in 2016 as it was in 1999. So somehow there is the general picture, even though kind of things have fluctuated quite a lot before the crisis and after and during the crisis, the long-term picture kind of has been one of relative stagnation. So, So I would just like to say a few... let me just skip on government debt. So let me just say a few, kind of our take on the euro. Basically, the euro, and I think people generally know that, the euro entry helped lower the rate at which Greece could borrow, and this led to a rise of investment and even greater rise in consumption, caused GDP to rise, and caused the current account deficit to rise, so imports minus exports. And this is actually, we see how huge and steep was this rise of Greece's imports relative to exports. So how much it has to borrow from abroad to finance this. And it's not surprising that essentially what happened during the crisis is the reverse of that process. The external borrowing had to stop. So Greece had borrowed exactly 100% of its GDP by 2007 from foreigners. And the mechanisms that caused the rapid rise after euro entry started running in reverse. So we had a large drop in GDP, and hence a sharp rise in debt to GDP. And actually, on the positive side, we had a stabilization in terms of an almost balanced current account from 2014 onwards. So now, what are we going to do in the rest of the talk? So we're going to dig deeper in these institutional problems, which we think are at the heart of the long-term stagnation. It's not about the euro, it's not about the macro picture, it's more about the micro level problems. So we're going to talk a bit kind of on the. We're going to look at the number of areas. On the pre-crisis side, we're going to show that the system was working efficiently, and in some ways it was sustainable because it was generating rents for some people at the expense of others. We're going to take a look at what happened during the crisis in various areas again, arguing that kind of things stabilized on the positive side and some inefficiencies were removed, yet many remain. And then we'll talk about priorities for future reforms and kind of give us our take of the economic outlook going forward. And we'll try also to highlight some broader implications about structural reform in the Eurozone. So this is the book that we have been advertising. It's called Beyond Austerity, Reforming the Greek Economy. It has just come out from MIT Press. And there is also a Greek edition. So the goal is to look at the economic institutions of the country and the economic incentives that they imply. This is what kind of we believe economists are good at, is to understand kind of how institutions and incentives relate. And so it's a collaborative effort of from Greek economists in Greece and the diaspora. And actually, this book would not have happened without the very generous help of the LSE's Hellenic Observatory for funding this research. A lot of research has gone in the book, data collection and processing, etc. And the HO, the Hellenic Observatory, has helped us a lot financially for that. So, and this is just a bunch of economists. This is the family picture. So, and on that note, let me give the floor to Kostas.
Ah, you have the... Well, so indeed, this is a large and collaborative effort, kind of coordinating, if you like, the international human capital of Greece to kind of work on understanding what are the rigidities and what are the distortions that took us into the crisis. Because our position, if you like, let me spell it out explicitly, is that the crisis was not caused by the euro and was not caused because of the enormous amounts of debt that Greece accumulated, but this debt was a symptom of the institutional rigidities, and indeed it was a process that the governments in the past used to cover the implications of these rigidities for growth. So I'm going to the book is very large, so I'm going to just talk about two main components two main institutional components that we think are important. The labor market and the tax system. So the Greek labor market before the crisis was heavily overregulated. But what's kind of interesting and, if you like, optimistic, is that there's been significant deregulation during the crisis. Now the Greek labor market does not have any more these incredible distortions, which I will briefly talk about. Now, what are the current problems? Of course, one of the big problems is the excessively progressive tax wedge. What we mean by tax wedge is the difference between how much a worker takes home with pay with how much an employer has to pay for that worker. And I will illustrate these numbers. They are quite impressive. The problem, of course, has been that a lot of emphasis during the crisis management has been on raising taxes in the formal sector, and as a result, this has led to very strong distortions. Now, just to give you a few indicators of the labour market to show you to indicate what kind of distortions we have. So if you look at Greece, you'll see about 36% of people are self-employed, right? So they are kind of own business people. That compares with 16% in the OECD. This indicates two things. It indicates a very large informal economy because a lot of these self-employed individuals are not really paying taxes but even more importantly, they are not engaged in activities that are at the frontier of growth, and they are not exporters usually. So you've got a large part of the economy absorbed as self-employed effectively because the formal sector is so prohibitive in Greece, either through bureaucracy or taxation or so on. The other thing that you might want to see is that 50% of the unemployed people are unemployed for more than a year. This is an enormous number. And that's before the crisis. Right, and if you compare just the benchmark it at that time in the rest of the OECD, which contains a lot of countries, not just the wealthier Eurozone countries, that's about 28-29%. This is the mobility in the labour market. So Greece, among these mainly OECD countries, has the lowest turnover in firms. Now, you might say this is a great thing, people are secure in the jobs. What this really shows is an inability of the economy to be dynamic, to create new jobs, to reallocate labor as new opportunities arise. If you look at, say, the U.S., and indeed Denmark, which is a kind of very interesting model because it's got an enormous social protection but doesn't interfere too much in the running of the economy, you've got hugely reallocation. And reallocation is the number of hiring and separations divided by employment. So this is an indication of how rigid the Greek labor market was before the crisis. And ultimately, it all adds up, this and many other stuff, to very low productivity per hour. This is the productivity per hour worked. At the best point, it reached 70% of the EU average. And now you might dispute these figures because perhaps ours are not measured too well, but what this is showing you is that all these rigidities, institutional factors, shift the economy towards less productive activities, right? And consequently, all this workforce is not producing as much as it produces in the average EU country. And indeed, for a large part of the time, it was much, much worse than that. So things are not looking particularly good. And these are things that far predate the acute element of the crisis. So what were the problems in the Greek labor market? So first of all, we had very large severance pay. You had to pay basically 11 months of salary to fire somebody. Now they've reduced that to 5 months, which is much, much better. Then you couldn't carry out collective dismissals, which was defined as 2% of the workforce of any firm, without having the approval of the Ministry of Labour. And of course, the Ministry of Labour would politicize that, and they would rather see firms being bankrupt than adjusting their workforce, because the minister would not want to sign off on firing 10 or 20 people in a large corporation. They've removed the requirement for ministerial approval. And they've replaced it with some kind of consulting thing. So this is pretty light touch now. And finally, there's an ingrained legal prerogative in favoring workers in the judiciary, which effectively means that the presumption is that the employer has abused their power when they try to terminate a contract or reallocate workers. Similar things for overtime. I have to go a bit faster because we're running on a very tight schedule here. So pay restrictions. So there were four levels of collective bargaining: national, sector, occupational, and firm. I won't go into much detail, but what's really interesting here and kind of a terrible feature of the Greek labor market, if there was a favorable agreement at any level, then this agreement would automatically be extended to all firms in the sector, even if they were not party to the negotiations. Now we've moved to effectively firm-level agreements, which of course is what you should be doing, and the automatic extension has been removed. Now, these regulations are effectively subsidizing the informal sector. They're making it extremely hard to work in the formal sector. Why does that matter? Because the formal sector is the exporting sector and is the high-tech sector, is the kind that's on the frontier. Right? So by having all these distortions, what you're effectively doing, you're moving economic activity to kind of low-level services and basically the unproductive informal sector, which is a really key problem in Greece. And finally, on this component, I want to show you what we call the tax wedge. So basically, suppose the employer has to pay 10,000 euros to an employee. The employee takes home 6,720. But the point is, okay, that's not that bad, but the point is that it accelerates, right? So when you reach a very high level of pay, the tax wedge has gone up to 68%. What does that mean? Effectively, it means that if a firm wants to hire a very skilled person, say even attract them from abroad or stop them from going abroad, then their labor costs have to increase exponentially. So they are basically disincentivized from doing that, and they are hiring kind of lower skilled people and keeping Greek industry at a much lower level, because going up the skill ladder is a very expensive process. Now, the next element, of course, that leads us directly into taxation. Now, taxation has two elements, right? The first of all is the level of taxation, which I kind of hinted, and next is the structure of the tax system. Now, in Greece, basically, we have a very complex tax system. We have no welfare program. For those who think that the money is being spent on welfare and so on, that doesn't exist in Greece, and that's actually a big negative, and I will explain why. So basically, we have these three elements: complexity, which both in income tax, so different types of income are treated completely differently. Salaries, capital gains, income from self-employment, they all have a different tax structure. Secondly, the tax base is very narrow, both because of the structure of the tax system and because it's distorted by evasion. And thirdly, the VAT has four different bands, kind of really, in some sense, intervening in product markets by trying to impose rates according to some arbitrary criteria. compliance is very low. So, for example, before the crisis, while the average EU country would raise 14% of its revenues from taxes, for Greece that was only 7%. And there's non-compliance in VAT as well. The non-compliance rate is about 30% of VAT compared to the EU, where the non-compliance is 9%. Now, where do we want to go? We would like to see the tax base broadened in two ways, both by improving compliance and also by actual reform. And we would like to see welfare programs introduced. Why do we want welfare programs? Because on the one hand, we're advocating a much more fluid labor market, a labor market that can hire and fire workers easily, start new businesses, and so on. But in order to do that in a socially stable way, you have to have a safety net that ensures that people are insured against negative shocks to their income. So we think that a properly operating dynamic economy has to have a good social insurance program. And one thing that we would like to stress is that we do not want journalists to pick up one little element and say, they want the labor markets to be, like the Wild West. Well, maybe we want a more fluid labor market, but at the same time, we want a good social safety net. In some sense, the kind of sentence is, we want to remove social protection from responsibility of the corporate sector, get social protection to be a responsibility of the public sector, and get the corporate sector to operate in a good business environment. So, we would like to see an alternative tax system. We want to see a shift to consumption taxation, much more emphasis on the VAT. We want to integrate the tax and welfare system in a way that I will quickly explain in my 3 minutes. In doing this, I'd like to say that you do not want, when you look at the whole tax and welfare system, you want to look at its progressivity overall, not by saying this element is regressive while this is progressive. What matters is the entire result. And the other thing that we're trying to push a lot in the book, both by doing it and by advocating it, is that a policy should be evaluated on evidence. It should be evidence-based. So we would like a VAT, we suggest a VAT-based system, most revenue collected from VAT, all expenditures taxed at uniform rate. Now you'll be shocked, a uniform rate of 27%, we're suggesting, and then only we abolish all income tax except for the top quartile of the income distribution, which pays one rate. At the same time, at the bottom of the distribution, we have welfare benefits that consist of a minimum income guarantee and an earned income tax credit. An earned income tax credit is effectively a negative income tax that subsidizes workers at the low end of the income distribution. So by having a high level of VAT, you automatically broaden the tax base, whether you're evading or you're getting your income from capital gains or dividends or salary, you pay tax, right, independently of whether you declare or not. Then you have a strong social safety net for the really low-income people, and that's the key point. So the advantage of a VAT-based system is it automatically broadens the tax base. It encourages savings. Now, compliance, that's very interesting. I just showed you that compliance with VAT is not that great. But you grow out of non-compliance, because when we get the economy to grow, the economy will grow with the formal sector. It doesn't grow with informality. It grows by creating new businesses that are outward-looking, exporting, and so on. These guys do not evade VAT. So although at the moment the compliance of VAT is probably as bad as compliance with income tax, as you're reducing, first of all, the dependence on income tax, and you're creating growth-enhancing policies, you grow out of compliance with VAT. Progressivity is assured by increasing the tax base, by welfare benefits at the bottom, and higher income tax rate at the top. So the top quartile of the income distribution will be paying an income tax of about 27% to 30%. I will conclude by showing you what the kind of marginal tax rates our system would imply, just to show you that it's actually quite progressive, the lower part of the income distribution has a negative marginal tax rate of about 7%. That's about an average subsidy to earnings at the bottom of the distribution of about 7%, while the top of the income distribution has a marginal tax, an overall marginal tax rate of 41%. So this is quite a progressive system. And with that, I will leave the floor to Dimitris.
All right. So let me talk a little bit about pensions. Sorry. All right. So pensions actually is an interesting story as well, because some progress was done during the crisis, but some important things were not done, and its problems remain. So how was the system pre-crisis? It was a recipe for disaster. So there were some big drawbacks. First of all, the system was not viable. So pension expenditure in 2007 was second highest in the EU. After Italy, it was 12% of GDP. And even more worryingly, while Italy had reformed its own pension system, Greece had not, and its expenditure was projected to double by 2016. It was unfair because rules mapping contributions to pensions differed greatly across professional groups, so professional groups that were more powerful could extract better pension entitlements, lower retirement ages, etc. And at the same time, partially because of this unfairness, despite all this expenditure, old age poverty was quite high. So poverty, rather, was concentrated primarily at old age. So some people were just not covered well. This relates with what Costa said about the lack of a welfare system. And the other part, it was very hard to reform it. So actually, there was a push for economic reforms in Greece in the run-up to the euro, and some good things happened. But everything ended in 2001, and the way it ended was with an attempt to reform the pension system. Actually, there was kind of a big reactions, and somehow the reform effort just fell flat. And actually, famously, the president of one of the Greek labor unions had said that first the pension system, the state would default, and then the pension system would default. He said this to just suggest that the pension system would never default, but in fact what he said was right, because the state actually did default, and then the pension system defaulted. Now, what happened during the crisis? So there were two basic goals. One is to make the system viable, by reducing pensions and raising contributions, and the other was to make rules more uniform to reduce unfairness. And so these things happened. So there were lots of changes, a constant kind of struggle between the government and the Troika to get things done. And now we're more or less in a state where there is a single pension calculation for broad professional groups, for the self-employed, for the employed, etc., that kind of give the same entitlements for everybody. There's a minimum pension plus a piece that is proportional to the number of years worked. So there has been significant progress. I mean, these are the viability and the fairness were significant problems. However, two significant things that were not addressed after all this work. One was that there were a lot of early retirements. So until 2016, lots of people went on fairly early retirement. This was kind of silly because the program, for example, there was this target that to meet employment in the public sector, to meet other requirements of the program, and partially as a result of that, this burdened the pension system. But this was not part of the target at some point. And anyway, and so this actually raised the pension expenditure in the medium term. And this is a nice picture that shows these were the projections for pension expenditure in Greece under the old system. This is and under the new system that actually after the first one of the first wave of reforms. So as you can see, pension expenditure was originally projected to increase very very significantly until 2016, what I said originally. So this problem was addressed with the first wave of reforms, but then pension expenditure actually increased in the short term because of these early retirements. The thing was kind of not thought out fully as part of a coherent strategy. And the way to deal with these overruns is shown in the next picture, which is that there were very significant cuts to existing pensions, which went from which were, of course, in the news all the time, but were particularly heavy in the higher pensions. So you can see some pensions were almost halved, both in the public and in the private sector. And what was even kind of worse is that there were about 10 consecutive cuts, not just one, but each of these cuts was advertised as the last one. So this somehow made the system, this had two effects. First of all, people lost trust on the system, and in particular, they thought that their pensions would not have any relationship with their contributions, because particularly some people who were cut very significantly here, some of them, had the long histories of contributions. So the problem right now is that contributions right now, because there is this link between pensions and contributions has essentially disappeared, contributions are perceived by and large as a labor tax and goes into the tax wedge that Kostas showed us earlier. It's part of the reason why the tax wedge is so large. Contributions are about 30% of this tax rate. And in the book, we devote a lot of effort into that. It's a nice chapter by Platon Tinius and Stavros Panagias. And we argue that a good way to address this problem is to go to a multi-pillar system that gives a significant role to individual retirement accounts, so individual pensions, private pensions. Actually, until recently, there were disincentives for private pensions. And under that system, contributions, assuming it's set up right, contributions will not be perceived as a labor tax, at least the part of contributions that goes into these individual retirement accounts. So there are ways to do that. There are transition problems, but also the ways to overcome the transition problems. Let me not spend more time on this, and let's go to the next person. But the point is that unless we go to some kind of solution like that, where state pensions are just part of the whole pot, it will be very difficult to overcome the drag of the pension system on growth, even though the viability problem has been addressed. Okay, Nico, over to you.
Okay, so I guess even under normal circumstances, economic policy can benefit from academic research. It doesn't always does. But economic policy in Greece has been really weird for the last many years. Greece has been in a recession since 2008, with a small exception of 2014. And it has been basically with no degrees of economic freedom since 2010. It has been cut off from the capital markets. And economic policy is actually not decided domestically. So it's a really interesting case study if you think about it. I'm sure that people in this building will be studying the Greek case 30 years from now, but I don't know if it will be kind of a bright example or a tragic one. And as Kostas already showed with the tax and the labor markets, and Dimitris also with the pension system, we try to go in as objectively and impartially as possibly go through sector by sector, try to see what have been best practices, where we are, and the ways forward. But let me try to take a little bit more of a general view. In some sense, the adjustment programs that Greece even now has is an implicit contract, where on the one hand, the European debtors and the IMF have assumed responsibility for the old sins, and that's the accumulated debt. On the other hand, Greece has assumed two responsibilities. One is not to create any new debt, so deficits have actually now been driven to zero, and at the same time, you have to fix the machine. Okay? And fixing the machine primarily means that you have to think about how product markets work, competition, public administration, and then even things like education and the judicial system. So let me say a word about these things and then try to give a little bit of perspective. Now, let's take these things one by one. Looking at the pre-crisis thing, one can get into lots and lots of detail, and of course we in the book and others elsewhere have done that. But how is everything connected? In the product markets, it is untrue that in Greece, in the pre-crisis period, you did not have high investment. But what you did have was investment primarily in sectors that were in non-tradables. People were very much into construction, into building houses, and so on and so forth. So if you actually look into businesses and if you look into sectors, the overall production had very low export orientation and very low innovative content. Okay? So there can be a long discussion on this, but this is related to entry barriers into market, most of them not legislated, but actually done de facto. That's one thing on the product markets. Let's actually think at the public administration. There is another, in some sense, myth that all of the problem of Greece's economy was that the employment in the public sector was huge. It was larger than average, but it was not that much out of proportion. What is true, however, is that the formalism with which the public sector was operating was an excessive burden on the private economy. And as I'm going to claim in a second, during the adjustment, the size of public administration has shrunk. However, its effectiveness has not increased. As a result, we are pretty much more or less where you were. And then I have to say a word on education. Education was one of the two areas where since the 60s, actually, or the 50s, the savings of the Greek household was going. The other one was building a house. So it wasn't as if the Greek families were not saving. But what they were putting their savings into was actually to build a house, because they didn't trust the formal areas of saving. And the other was education for their system, for their children. So there is a massive push for everybody to get high-quality education. But the thing is, how does this click with a product market that is not extrovert? All right. Just very few graphs. Even though the OECD has named Greece the champion in reforms in the last 2 or 3 years, that's the increment. In terms of level, I don't always trust soft indicators, but at some level you have to trust them, okay? Greece is at the very bottom of the OECD competitiveness index. And in some sense, this is a story of a country that is stuck in the middle. Wages are not very low, but then institutions are not very good. But it basically means you have to do something about it if you are at the bottom. Likewise, Greece is very low. I'm also comparing this to the UK since we are in London. We are very low in the innovation index. And then let's see a number of... This is the key graph for understanding the collapse of the Greek economy in the last few years and perhaps how you can turn things around. So total investment in the last few years has been around 10 or 11% of GDP. When compared with about 23 or 24 of GDP in the pre-crisis years, and with also the Eurozone and European average. Now, this collapse of investment you have to understand in at least three ways. One is that there was consistent and very often very sharp macroeconomic and political uncertainty. So if you happen to be in not only an economic but also a social system where you don't know how the next month is going to be, you would be crazy to invest. In that sense, the adjustment program has been a huge failure because the threat that if you don't make such and such a progress in such and such a secondary area, I am actually going to cut off the money on Monday morning. This drove all money out of the country. Now, another way that you can understand this collapse of investment is, as I noted before, a very significant part of investment was going into construction and housing. So to turn into investment into tradables, especially when initially you didn't know exactly where you would belong in the world economy, actually took some years. We see some signs of this now taking place. For instance, this is an interesting graph that shows that due to the collapse of domestic demand, companies were trying to find profit abroad, but in their effort to do this, they had to decrease prices because they were not competitive enough. then you can also see that overall, Greece is not a very open economy. It's, on average, much less open, especially when it comes to the trade of goods, than the other Eurozone economies. In services, Greece is, primarily because of tourism and shipping services. But that's an issue and has to be corrected. Now, there's lots of analysis that can go into, for instance, the public sector. The main issue was not the size itself, but what has happened is a significant reduction in the number of public employees and a significant reduction in their wages. However, not much of a restructuring, in particular in the way of structuring incentives. As a result, the impact of the public sector in the overall economy, rather than shrinking, has increased. Then there is education. Education has been out, most of the times, out of these formal adjustment programs because it is considered to be something a little bit broader. Now, Greece, at all levels, has a fairly open system. If you want to go to a university, you pretty much can. However, as is also explained in lots of analysis, as you can actually see, employment for university graduates in Greece is at the very bottom of the employment rate in whole of Europe. Now you're going to say this is normal since overall unemployment is high. However, there is a very significant problem that has not been addressed, even during the crisis, which is if you actually measure where people that get a degree are actually preparing themselves to go, four out of five of them, they are preparing for employment in the broader public sector. So even though the public sector is not one that can hire anybody from now on and for the next 30 years, the education system has not actually shifted itself the way it should. We put this graph in here not only to indicate that Greece is very low in R&D per capita in universities, but also to indicate that the UK is not at the top, as you might think. All right. Now, I think, however, and then I'm going to say this and try to generalize and wrap up, that people have studied Greece over the last few years are going, if they have to point to one area, that has to be the way the judicial system works. Because even if you fix pretty much everything else, in the end there has to be a rule of law. I'm not myself into law, so I don't know, I honestly cannot say anything about the quality of the legal decisions. I'm hearing they may be very good. However, they are amazingly slow. And slow justice is basically no justice. That is not because of the lack of resources. For instance, there are judges, and actually, if you look into where many of the bright Greeks are going, many of them they're going into law school and they're becoming lawyers. Now, in the end, many of these lawyers, if you happen to be somebody who has an arithmetic mind, they just cancel out in terms of GDP. One is just fighting against the other and not having much of a productive outcome given the way the system is judged. All right. Now, Dimitris is showing papers to
you. We have time, 5 minutes, okay.
Yes. This slide is supposed to show for these four areas, first, what took place during the crisis, and then a possible way forward. So, in particular for product markets, there has been some serious deregulation, in particular through the OECD programs, what they call the Product Markets Toolkit, reduction of the formal entry barriers, and we do observe a shift from non-tradables to tradables. However, this has been a slow process, which actually is hidden under the stronger force, which is that the overall collapse of investment. So it is as if you have been fixing the machine, but there is no fuel. One particular problem area that needs to be addressed in the next year or two is non-performing loans, not only as a matter of saving the banks, but primarily as a matter of fueling new blood into the economy. Likewise, in the public administration, there isn't much waste now. There has been a significant reduction in the resources. However, the structure and the incentives need to be put in place, something that is extremely difficult. In education, that's the one area where I can say clearly that the picture is not mixed. All the steps have been backwards. Backwards towards a system that is excessively controlled by the state or the government. In the justice system, there has been some slow progress. However, unless there is a significant simplification of the legal framework, along with employing all these new, meaning digital technologies, so that people can have access, not much can be done. Now, I'm concluding with this. How perhaps we can think about the Greek crisis? Because most of the, I think, 31 people that we were involved in writing this book, we didn't do it for fun. It was primarily because we do think that Greece has, but under very strict conditions, the potential to become a very vibrant, small, open European economy. However, there is a number of things that need to be addressed. Yes, the economy has been stabilized. Many people didn't think that was possible without having a currency devaluation, but it did happen. It did happen through a parliamentary democratic process. Fine, done. However, from where we are, we believe that we should not misinterpret this stability with the fact that the crisis is over. The crisis is not over, and it will not be over until you actually get into a balanced growth path. And for that, you have to insist in all the boring details that we just made you go through, which is issues that have to do with liberalization of markets and strengthening of institutions. And we could actually have a lot to say in particular about the tax reforms, pensions, and so on and so forth. Now, one of the factors that made the adjustment of the Greek economy very hard during all these 8 or 9 years now has been the fact that it has been always moving at the edge of the cliff. And the question mark was about the currency. Many people actually thought, wrongly, as Dimitris explained, that the problems of the Greek economy were because of the euro, and all you had to do is actually to become even poorer so that you can start again. But if you do understand that, if you do believe that the problem is the functioning of institutions, then what you want is long-run credibility. And for that, for Greece to remain in the eurozone, which was a collective decision made by the country, was the right thing to be done, and that's a base on which it has to build. Final words. There is lots. Greece was not the only country that actually got into trouble. There were 4 more countries in formal programs: Portugal, Ireland, and Cyprus. Ireland was toying with exactly where its banks are going to go. And even as we speak, very serious European economies like Italy and France, they're looking into the next 10 years with a lot of question marks. They have higher debt, they have adverse demographics, and low productivity. So lots of the issues that we are actually touching in the book are actually common across many European economies. For various reasons, Greece found itself in a very difficult corner. But if you really have to think about how Europe is going to grow, then you have to think more or less in the same ways about tax and so on and so forth. For Greece, in the same way that looking backwards is actually the glass is half full, half empty, looking forward, one can describe a very positive scenario that takes into account also the new global regime, as well as a negative scenario, but I guess this could come up in the discussion. I'm done.
Okay, very good. So, yeah. Okay, we can go. 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 We
Συστήσεις.
Well, I'll introduce myself. Yeah, no.
Okay, so we have our two discussants. First of all, Yanis Manuelidis. He's a partner at Allen Overy.
Thank you. I'm a lawyer. Let's start with. Thank you very much for inviting me, and thank you all for having the patience to sit through all of this. I hope you will all read the book. It's a fantastic book. Don't read it when you're tired. It's hard work, but do read it. It is very challenging, and it has a lot of very interesting proposals. The authors have tried to drill down onto lots of specific things, and in addition to the analysis, which is extremely valuable, there are lots of policy proposals. So I really think that this is a fantastic book. I really, when I sat early in the morning, well rested to sort of deal with it, I found it fascinating. So thank you very much for asking me to read it and comment at least discuss some topics that come out of it. Now, the first question I came to my mind when reading this book was, why is it that this discussion and this book is coming, from a bunch of academics, most of whom live abroad, and there's no political party involved in this sort of discussion, domestic academia involved, but only sort of marginally so. This is an interesting question. I think we all need to think about it and consider what it means if we're going to think of how this thing is going to kind of move forward. Because ultimately, it's good to sort of talk and think about these problems in the way they've been presented. But another way to think about Greece and where it is to think of of it as a very obese person with serious health problems, and obesity is basically the debt. But you don't become obese like that. Become because you follow bad habits. And to break out of these habits is extremely difficult. And you can go to the doctor, and the doctors will say, guys, this is what you need to do. You need to look at my 10 recommendations. But you still need to find someone who's going to persuade the patient to change their habits. And you need to think about that in the absence of sort of a political sponsor, basically, for not for this book, but so much the absence of political participation in this debate. Now, I want to talk about two or three things that have been actually mentioned before. The first is how important I thought this book was for the whole Eurozone, which is a point that Nikos made, and we completely, and unless Dimitris has whispered something in your ear, we completely not discussed it before. Because as I was reading all these statistics, and I really urge you to go and see them, I called actually Dimitri and said, look, you guys need to expand this program. You need to do all this for all the Eurozone countries. You need to do it with better colors, actually, than what you have in the book, sorry, one complaint. But you need to do it because these are the sort of things that if we actually knew in the years the following 2000, we would not be here where we are. Because it's perfectly clear that the bad habits we're building up, and it's perfectly clear where we're heading. Now, for lots of reasons that we're not going to discuss now, but everybody knows, the Eurozone was not in the mood to sort of produce these figures, and there were all sorts of other incentives not to bring them up. But going forward, especially if this European IMF is going to be built, I have no doubt that these numbers will have to be looked at. And I have no doubt that because now we have Italy and France involved with difficult problems, these things will need to be discussed. And the other thing that needs to be discussed like that is also, and will come forward, is something very important, which is, which is about Greece and the rest of the Eurozone. I mean, Greece has always been blamed as the grasshopper, the lazy grasshopper of the Eurozone. In my mind, it was always the canary in the mine. It's just basically the most extreme case. And looking at the numbers and drilling down at the numbers and comparing actually brings this out and brings it very clearly and shows how lessons learned in Greece can actually be beneficial elsewhere. It also will highlight, it seems to me, what needs to happen on the other side in the famous debate about the surplus countries. because once you start looking at exactly who is the creditor, who is the debtor in the Eurozone, and towards whom, immediately the issues about how you have to take steps to balance is very important. Now, as I said, this is a huge work to be done. And my approach to this, I am a lawyer after all, it is that, you know, you've got to start small. And, you know, small is beautiful, it's also more digestible, it's politically more palatable. So I always thought that, and that's something I've been discussing with Greek colleagues. I'm not Greek qualified, but I do work with lots of colleagues, very good colleagues in Greece. And we thought, well, wouldn't it be a great idea to set a program where we set small things that can easily be changed and everybody will understand them? They don't cost really anything, and in fact will have a significant effect. And I'll just want to give you some examples. And again, I'm a lawyer. You've all heard of mortgages in Greece. Well, you know, in fact, technically, nobody uses a mortgage in Greece because it's fantastically expensive. They use something which is called a mortgage pre-notation, which is in fact a judicial mortgage. You go to the court, and the court basically says, you know, I order that the mortgage be created. And you go there, actually, and both parties lie to the court. They say, here's a debt I cannot pay. And in fact, the debt has not even been advanced. So they both lie to the court, and they sit before a court, which I think is three judges. Now, I mean, that's for every mortgage that's out there in the market. Now, imagine just the savings in court time if you change that. And the only reason it's not happening is because the notaries and the lawyers, certain lawyers, and the people who are in charge of the notation of the mortgages don't want it. And it's very simple. Now, the checks, and you know, checks in Greece are equivalent to cash. They're used effectively as promissory notes. Why are they used as promissory notes? Because we pay stamp duty. Why are we paying stamp duty? Nobody uses promissory notes. There's no collections from the stamp duty. So we have criminalized the promissory note by pushing it towards tax, which is because it's equivalent to cash. If it's not honored, it's it's a criminal offense. So, I mean, these are this. I mean, I can bring you more examples. Now, for, you know, the last thing I want to say is about tax. And it was mentioned before. It's extremely important to have a debate about tax. If there is no national debate about tax, which is where does it go, who pays it, where does it go, how is it spent, and we're never going to begin the political process. This is the big picture discussion. To my memory, we've never had this discussion. You know, we have never had this discussion about whether it's labor, whether it's entrepreneurship, whether it's capital that pays tax, and it's, I think, high time we do it. I think my time's up, right?
So okay. Thank you, Rodiani.
Thank you.
Okay, so Ricardo, Rhys, professor at the LSE, macro.
Great. Okay. Well, thank you for having me. It's really a pleasure to be here. I'm not Greek. I look at Greece from the outside and from someone who's been interested in that, in a lot of the crises that we've had across Europe and the adjustment programs and what they involve. It was really a pleasure to read this book. I strongly recommend that you all get it and have a look at it, especially because it was a very ambitious undertaking. There are many authors involved, and the series of authors that while all living outside of Greece, decided to become engaged in this public debate through this book, which is much harder and in some ways less rewarding than just writing a series of op-eds. It's a well-known fact, I think, or certainly my appreciation, that when one looks at countries like the UK or the US, the size and the depth of the academic community and the policy-making community means that you have a series of books that perform serious studies of the state of the economy. Whereas when one goes to Greece or Portugal or Spain, or even to a small extent Italy, it ends up that the public debate happens in op-eds and in newspaper pieces, which by their very nature have a very short lifespan. And as a result, it's very difficult for me to go and I wanted to go and read something about the Greek economy 10 years ago, 15 years ago, to see to what extent these authors have been preempted. And there's nothing. And it's not that there wasn't a debate in Greece, it's just that it lives in newspapers and op-eds, in public debates in some regards. Greece is a very active country in many ways in terms of public debates, but there's not a production of books, and as a result, which will be a little more perennial. And the authors are to be congratulated by that. On top of that, they assembled a diverse set of people, and so they have avoided having a too common message. There are contradictions across different chapters, but very welcome contradictions. This is not a case where we have a magic recipe to solve problems, but rather several different approaches that are, for the most part, complementary. Greece, in some ways, is a difficult problem because it's not a very poor country. Greece is a rich country, not as rich as it should be or as we'd like it to be. And as a result, there's many small factors. And instead of revolution, what one needs is a sober assessment of a series of, if you want, diagnostics of the problem that will all add up to it. And finally, the solutions that the authors propose are all feasible in the sense of not unrealistic. We're not, again, asking for a large revolution. And so, in spite of its great ambition, this book is, in my view, a great success for all of the reasons. What is the diagnosis that the authors make? First, if you want to summarize in one sentence, it is that the Greek problem is a problem that is structural. It is a combination, if you want, of low productivity growth, of too little investment for a very long time and certainly after the crisis, and in many ways something that didn't come up in the slides, but a lack of political ownership of reforms, of there not being a coalition that acknowledges that there is a problem and that pushes systematically to solve it within the country, within the different political forces in the country. Why? What are these structural problems? The authors highlight schooling and labor market rigidities, problems with education and labor markets, very high and very inefficient tax system, the need for product market reforms together with the reform of the judiciary, and as well as, not mentioned in this talk, but that deserves quite a bit of attention in the book, reforms to the corporate governance and shareholder protection and the courts in that regard. And finally, reforms to the safety net, the way in which social protection, pensions, and others are, insofar as the Greek system seems to be very expensive right now, without outcomes that seem to be particularly good when it comes to protecting people from poverty. Those are the main structural problems, we would say. The author's solutions, therefore, is for structural reform. And on this, I will again congratulate the authors, because whenever I hear the word structural reform in the context of Europe and its problems, I get very worried. Structural reform is what Brussels has been saying for 20 years, is an excuse to do very little about anything. You can always say the problems are structural. It excuses you to say, well, whatever solution will have an effect 30 years from now. And moreover, all we need to do then is to go and copy some country. Let's all try to be, and this depends from 5 years to 5 years, and depending on your political orientation, we all want to be Americans, we all want to be the Nordic model, or so and so. And structural reforms far too often in Europe, in European debates, all the way going back to Maastricht, if not before, are just a big excuse not to do anything. That is not the case of the authors. When they say structural reform, they, in my view, take the right view, which is instead of looking for a model to copy, they take the view, which I think is absolutely correct and much more productive, which is that when it comes to structural adjustment, countries don't need to converge, they can jump. When there's a need to copy, because when one looks at the U.S., when one looks at the Nordic countries, whichever one is your favorite, the Japanese, the Chinese, whatever is your fancy, all of those countries are in the situation they are, they're very far themselves from being the optimum, from being at what's ideal, because all these countries have their own rigidities. If one is going to reform, one should think about what's the ideal, how to design these different systems. And for instance, the tax reform that Kostas presented is one that many countries, certainly, for instance, the United States, has been discussed for a long time as being possible, desirable. The U.S. system is far from it, to give an example of a country. And as a result, these structural reforms are well thought out to both fit the Greek phenomenon, but also to try and lead to a jump that will lead to a concrete benefit to Greece. Moreover, structural reforms, another reason why I often get frustrated when I hear structural reforms, is that it often confuses the fact that Greece and its level is not as rich as the UK, with the fact that in terms of its changes, it has gone through a recession. You use structural reforms both to explain why Greece is not as rich as it should be, as well as why it had a big recession. And again, here the authors are to be congratulated for not making that confusion, which again comes very, very often, far too often from Brussels. And I'll give you an example in which they don't make that confusion. There's a difference between saying that labor markets are rigid in a macro sense, instead of adjusting to a shock. That is not an issue in Greece right now. Wages fell, unemployment moved. It is not about wage flexibility or downward nominal rigidities or the type of things that that macroeconomists like to talk about. The issue instead is micro-flexibility, or as I think Kostas showed, it is about churning in the labor market. It's about the ability from workers to move from one sector to another that seems to indeed be the big barrier in Greece. So, having said, this is an ambitious project, identifies structural problems, thus identifies structural reforms, and does all of these, I think, in a very good way. And so far, I have been very flattering of the project. It's my job as a discussant, though, to be, especially being an economist, to be somewhat negative about some things. So let me give three constructive criticisms about this book. The first one, in the short run, as I think Nikos was the one who mentioned it, it's important to have a rebound in investment. To understand the last 7 years, it is the big slump in investment, and it's especially the stagnation in investment, the fact that there's been essentially no rebound. That investment fell in 2008 and 2009, is not particularly shocking, given the size of the shock. That it hasn't recovered as of 2017, that is what's very worrying and what makes us very worried about Greece. Why is that? Well, partly, there's a very large public debt burden still. And so as a result, for me to invest in Greece, I worry that the state will tax away any profits or any capital that I invest. Banks are saddled with lots of non-performing loans, and as a result, they themselves don't want to engage into new loans. Public administration is heavy, and as a result, there is a constant need for taxation that is distortionary and that is large in order to keep the machine going. Foreign direct investment is difficult when I know that there's capital controls that can be that can come in at any time. And perhaps most importantly, as I think Nikos also mentioned, is the fact that with the amount of political uncertainty that one has had, with Greece having been at the edge of a cliff almost even today, people will mention it that way, it is very hard to convince any foreigner investor to engage in any type of long-term project when reversibility, the ability to take the money out of Greece quickly, becomes paramount to the extent that there's a sense of the cliff. All these combine to say that if one thinks about why does an investment recover, is that Greece is in a sense in what one might call an expectations trap. Because I expect that any investment that I make will be quickly taxed, cannot be reversed, that we're at the edge of the cliff. I do not want to invest in the first place, which of course makes us be on the cliff, close to the cliff and not recovering as well. Breaking this trap is not an easy thing. Interventions by the Troika or by the IMF are successful in stopping instead the downward spiral in which the crisis was based, but it is not an external intervention that can make a country stop from the stagnation that these expectations will continue, as I think the experience of Greece of the last 3 years testifies. To break it, I think what one needs is, and this is the sense in which this is a criticism of the authors, one needs to focus on a small subset of reforms that tries to get you out of that expectations trap. So what I would like them to do, see more in the discussion, is to say, well, what are the things that one would do? And the other discussant already mentioned, tried to do a little bit of that. But I would say focus on investment. What is the smaller subset of reforms that would let you escape this expectations trap? My own preference goes to some of the things that Kostas mentioned. A deep reform in the tax system, including sometimes politically unpopular reforms to the corporate tax system and to investment credits, that lead to a big encouragement to savings, and that come with a commitment designed in some legal sense that there will be some fiscal stability looking forward. Taxes are not everything. They're not, perhaps not even the main determinant of investment, but they're a big thing that one can change in the relative short time. Likewise, in dealing with the debt burden, a reform of public administration that says that future taxes won't be necessary and won't in order to feed the beast, as well as a reform of the pension system. Both of those give a strong signal that, indeed, the investor will be protected from being taxed. I don't know if those are the better ones, but I know that in order to break an expectations trap, one needs some form of leadership, political leadership certainly, but I don't think the authors are competent to talk about it, but at least they can provide the leadership and ideas on what are the key two key or three features that would allow us to jumpstart investment in terms of key reforms. There's certainly international experience of this happening. I'm not just dreaming about it, but one can jumpstart investment through a few key reforms. Second point, second somewhat criticism. A difficulty, a lesson from development, from adjustment programs and development economics more generally, is that is the one that comes from the so-called theory of the second best. When there are many problems, such as the ones that the authors identified, the difficulty is that if one goes and changes just one out of many, one may actually make things worse off. For instance, liberalizing firing without any product market regulation, without any change in pensions and others, can easily make the situation in Greece actually significantly worse, even if liberalizing firing is one of the things that is part of the author's package. As a result of having many different chapters, the authors do not at the end talk about what's the sequencing of the reforms, which is the crucial lesson on how to do when one is stuck in these second best worlds. But again, I would like them in the discussion to speak more about that. One could not implement their entire package immediately. I've already said what the first step should be, something that spurs investment. But more about what the sequence of the other reforms should be is important in order to make sure that this is a sustainable change for Greece and one that gets also a coalition of people behind it. Third and final criticism in my last 3 minutes, and hopefully, again, my criticism have been more attempts at pushing the authors to move forward, maybe towards another book. I don't want to burden them that way. But the third one is that the authors rightly emphasize that, in a sense, too much has been said about the euro and about debt as being the problem. And I think one of them said, this is not the problem. The problem is structural adjustments. I think that is correct, but at the same time, it's somewhat too strong. The euro, or if you want, the entrance in the euro in 2000, was not the cause of the Greek problems, but certainly interacted with them. I don't think the problems that we had in the last few years would have been there. There would have been different problems. I'm not saying there would have been no problems if there was no euro per se. Now, the authors, I think, do this strongly because they are very right in trying to avoid a discussion that unfortunately has taken far too much ink in Europe, let alone in Greece, which is the fact that even though one can have an intellectually interesting discussion whether Greece should have joined the euro or not, that is a very different discussion from saying whether it should leave now. There's a strong asymmetry between leaving and between entering and leaving. And I am completely convinced by their arguments and those of many others that leaving would be a very bad idea for Greece right now. So even if one thinks the euro was at fault for some of the problems, leaving the euro is not the solution. At the same time, I think the interaction of some of the structural problems that they discussed with the existence of the euro was important. The reason why I say that is precisely that you see that it was the countries that joined the euro that in 2000 and that shared some of the structural problems that the authors identified. Many of the problems identified are common to Portugal, Ireland in different ways, by the way, but with some commonality. And in all of them, we see some strong similarities. In particular, a very large inflow of capital. I don't think it was the euro per se that mattered in the sense of a currency. It's not about the fixing of the exchange rates, which again I think take too much attention. It was the creation of a unique capital market that led to a very large flow of capital from the core to the periphery countries of Europe. This large flows and the very large current account deficits that came with it meant that these countries' structures, if one wants, had to deal with what to do with all this capital coming from the core. They clearly did not deal with them well. Meaning this capital was not allocated to the most profitable sectors, was not used to expand the export sector and others. Part of the problem was political. Too much of the capital that went into Greece went into public spending of different forms. Part of it was structural in terms of the credit markets, insofar as too much of it, as was noted before, went into smaller firms and the difficulty that Greece has of small firms growing. It's not the problem that Greece has lots of small firms. It's how few small firms get medium and large in Greece that is more of a problem, and that is where the capital from abroad should have helped and did not. One could tell a story in 1995 that the reason why Greece did not have more exporters is that they lacked capital. Then capital came between 2000 and 2008 from the core, and yet this jump from small firms to medium firms to large firms is what seemed to be lacking in entrance of the export sector. A third factor, likewise, is that capital came, and yet capital had trouble finding the skilled labor, who instead, given the incentives and the structure of pay in the economy, preferred instead to have a public sector job as opposed to using this capital from abroad for entrepreneurship. So the combination of those tells me that it is the combination of the interaction between the structural problems and how to deal with large capital flows from abroad and entrance, that is, if you want the true liberalization of the capital markets that happens in very large part with the euro, the creation of a European capital market with capital flows, that interacted with the flows of capital, and that led to a somewhat of a boom and bust in Europe, in Greece post 2000. I think the authors acknowledge this, but in their eagerness to say it's not about the euro, the currency, but it is partly about the euro, the capital market, and that is part of it. And the reason why I mention this is not because I'm interested in diagnosis of 2008. The authors rightly look forward, as one should, but rather because in dealing with these capital flows is going to be a challenge of the Greek economy, especially, and going back then to the beginning of my talk here, that in terms of attracting investment, attracting capital, the ability to then deal with reversals of that capital, I think, will be important for Greece. To conclude, I lauded the author's ambition and declared that their effort was a clear and, in my view, unambiguous success. Their identification of structural problems, structural solutions, went far beyond the common places that too often dominate this literature, but their effort was instead sober, not revolutionary, but comprehensive and important, and will serve an incredibly important role when discussions of this happen, both today as well as 10 years or even 50 years from now. And I made three constructive remarks or criticisms, if you want, for discussion. First, what to do to jumpstart investment, to drop the expectations trap. Second, after that, what should be the sequence of your reforms, not to fall into the fact that individual reforms may not improve things, at least in the short run. And thirdly, how to deal with large capital flows in and out, because in staying in the euro, it will come with this capital, with these large capital flow, if you want, volatility that is part of what being in the euro is. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ricardo, and thank you to all of the authors and the discussants. My name is Hugo Dixon. I am a journalist and an entrepreneur and a campaigner. I am also, like Ricardo, not Greek, although I am 1/8 Greek and I have a house on a Greek island, so I feel partly Greek. Now, it seemed to me that the authors have made it. What we're going to have is we're going to have a bit of Q&A, but I'm going to ask the first question. But also just to give my sort of perception of big picture listening to what has been said. And it certainly dovetails with my experience following the Greek crisis through most of its twists and turns, is that there is a big structural problem. But, and this is my question really, is what is actually underlying these structural problems, and why has Greece not been able to address them satisfactorily? We talk about rents. Who are the rent seekers? We talk about barriers to entry. Who can we name names? Who are the people who are actually stopping these barriers to entry being removed? We talk about, you know, tax evasion. Why is there ultimately? Why is there such a high level of non-performance in income tax and VAT? It seems to me, my perception is, it's a collective action problem. When you take a Greece out of Greece and you put them in Britain, they're quite capable of being compliant with paying their taxes. And if you put a Brit into Greece after a few years, they'll be quite capable of not paying their taxes. So it seems to me, people talk as though it's when they talk about, they say it's all about, it's in the DNA. I don't believe that for one moment. I think it's a sort of free rider problem, collective action problem. But what is behind, and this really brings me also then to two remarks that the discussants made. I mean, the first was Yanis's problem, which it's all very well. The doctor to tell the patient you're obese, go on an exercise regime and eat the proper food, but they may not do it. And what Ricardo said about the expectations trap, it seems to me, and you hinted at it when you actually talked about political ownership, what I think is standing in the way is that there is a political problem. And you can't look at economics on its own. You have to look at it in the context of political economy. And we talk about, and the big problem is there doesn't seem to be anybody who's really prepared to own. I mean, you've come up with this very radical and catching idea of a 27% VAT and scrapping income tax for everyone in the bottom three quartiles of the income range. That may be absolutely brilliant suggestion, but who is going to implement it? But here's my question: how are we going to get the political impetus to make the changes that you talk about? And linked to that, this is my fear: have we actually wasted the crisis? Have we actually lost the moment where there was the maximum chance of getting that political impetus? So maybe we could have, I mean, don't think all of you should answer that, but maybe we could have two views, Nikos and maybe Kostas. Nikos first. And then I'll open to the floor.
You didn't ask an easy question.
Good. Name names.
Okay. Let me start with a little bit of the positive side of things, and then I'm going to end up with a little bit less positive. So on the one hand, if you really want to make a list of actual structural reforms that have been implemented in various areas, lots has happened. Okay, and actually we shouldn't minimize the efforts and the results. For instance, Greece went from a completely Byzantine tax collection system into a system that is 100% online and electronic in 1 year and 3 months. And everybody was saying this cannot happen. How about, you know, the old people and so on and so forth? It did happen. And now Not every country in Europe has this. We are one of the few countries in Europe that have this. Likewise, there was a transition to 100% electronic medical prescriptions, mm-hmm. and this was done in 6 months. And I'm not saying it was the result of that, but public expenditure into medicine was decreased from 6 billion per year to 2.5 billion per year. So you can actually go areas by areas and you can find success. Now, that's one thing. That's not an answer to your question. Let me say another thing, which may...
Is this an answer to my question? Where is the political impetus going to come for these radical reforms that you're talking about?
Okay.
Looking to the future.
The second thing I'm going to say, it's closer.
Have we wasted this crisis?
It's closer to an answer to your question.
Okay.
I think you touched upon two very sensitive things that economists really worry about. One is incentives, and the other is that systems are kind of an equilibrium of various incentives. So you cannot just change one thing. You have to change everything. So now you're asking how you go from here to there if lots of people are going to lose in the short run with a promise that they're going to gain in the longer run. Mm-hmm. One thing that can move this is actually money. What you did describe actually was built in over decades as a result of having access to easy foreign debt. Now this is done. And actually I'm not worried about, you know, how money can go in and out. There is very little money that's going to flow into the public sector over the next 20 years. As a result, just by itself, is going to change the relative prices in Greece. If you keep those of them who will be doing the rent sinking or however you want to call it, they're going to have much less of a return that they had in the past. In some sense, now you are also saying that for me, the largest failure of the program was that rather than discriminate amongst those that would be, let's say, the productive ones in various areas, it was pretty much a horizontal pressure on everybody. Take, for instance, academics. All right.
Okay, but now you're looking back to the past again. I mean, I'm gonna bring Kostas in now and ask you directly: have we wasted the best opportunity? Have we actually wasted the chance to change? Have we wasted this crisis?
We have wasted a large part of a good crisis that could have allowed us to reform, and the politicians in Greece never bought into the reform. We have to remember that neither the centre-right nor the centre-left was pro-reform. They lived off a clientelistic system that started being built, well, a long time ago, but particularly in the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
The debt and the tax evasion served to bribe the middle class not to object to the various populist policies. And now you've created a bunch of interest groups that are very tied to the current system. Right. For example, pharmacists, they have a guaranteed profit rate. Truckers have, or used to, but you know, have a guaranteed protected profession. And, you know, basically, to drop a name, Machiavelli originally said that the reformers' big problem is that the losers of the reform know exactly who they are, while the benefits are so diffuse that they do not come together. So what's the answer? The answer is, as Nico said, incentives. So a few years ago, this team of people here that you're sitting here proposed something that was very concrete. We said, okay, these are the bunch of reforms that need to be done. And this is the massive debt. Okay, create a structure whereby the debt is gradually restructured as specific reforms are implemented. That immediately creates a bunch of very clear beneficiaries, mm-hmm. and a good outlook for Greece. But, of course, that requires the vision from the creditors as well. But the proposal is very simple. We know that the debt is unsustainable. There's no way that Greece can continue living with 3.5% surpluses. Mm-hmm. That's going to drown any growth. Use that to force the Greek political system into reforms, bit by bit. As every time that the tranche is implemented, restructure part of the debt by increasing maturities, freezing interest rates, and you'll have it happen.
I must say I like that. The problem is that I'm afraid I think the creditors are getting bored and they're just not prepared to put that sort of detailed effort into Greece anymore. But let's open up to the wider audience. Please, if you have questions, keep them short, and we want questions, and identify yourself. Put your hand up. I think we've got someone with a microphone. Have we got? Yes, we have. The man with the red T-shirt. So please put up your hand. Any questions? Okay, we have at the back this young lady at the back, and then we're going to have someone here.
Thank you very much. Is the microphone working? Yes.
Yeah.
My name is Kira Gardu Katsugiani. I'm a PhD student here at LSE. So first of all, it has been a privilege to be here. I would like to ask the following. So you said that not only the euro is not the root cause of Greece's malaise, but also that exiting the long-term stagnation is easier within the common currency, if I understood properly. And I think the latter part of this statement, I fundamentally agree with it, but I think it sounds a bit odd in a foreign audience. So I'd like you to talk a bit more about why this is the case. And is it just because of conditionality and common rules, or is there something more to it that the pro-reform constituency benefits from the Eurozone membership, and therefore this is linked to the political economy of reform that Mr. Dixon was referring to? Thank you.
I think, Dimitri, you should probably pick that one up.
Let me just make sure that I understand. The question is, you're saying,
why is it easier to exit stagnation in Greece while staying inside the common currency?
Okay.
That's what she would like you to explain, particularly for a British audience.
Okay.
Who might have grown up reading lots and lots of articles saying that the solution is Grexit?
Okay. Well, we think that the main benefit is of remaining in the euro is the incentive benefit. So let me explain that. So there are a number of things. First of all, As we showed you some graphs that showed that just the anticipation of Greece being part of the Eurozone caused, like in the late 90s, caused a big increase in investment. So because with this came the expectation that Greece was going to be part of this kind of club of advanced economies. We would have some stable interest rates. I mean, if it had stayed at the time with the drachma, there would be kind of constant uncertainty about the value of the drachma. There would be risk premia at which firms could borrow at higher interest rates. So so this part of it is this stability. And the other thing is this incentive benefit, which that staying in the euro and kind of just not reforming and kind of keeping... not reforming would be very painful because the currency devaluation tool is missing. It will be kind of unemployment will keep remaining high. So any government that wants to do well, and even the current government that wants somehow to be wants to do well in the next elections, they will think hard about finding some way for the economy to grow. So maybe they will not do all the reforms that we're advocating, but at least they will think about some. So it's a discipline device. If you are out of the euro, you can always, at least not always, but you can in the short run, you can kind of cover the problems with the currency devaluating. So I think this is the main advantage, the discipline device.
The discipline. Okay, and then we have a question here. Please tell us your name.
Marcus Johnson. I heard nothing there about the reasons. Somebody once asked me, would I invest in Greece a few years ago? And the reasons that I seem to remember citing were the customs regime, corruption and licensing. And I didn't hear any of those as being mentioned in the book. Are they?
Does anyone want to, one of the three of you, pick it up? Nico.
Yeah, we didn't mention all this here, but it is described in the book and elsewhere. Right now, if you're asking why somebody would or would not invest in Greece, depends on, somebody called it the expectations formation. If you read the situation right, you can become really rich by investing in the Greek economy right now. If you don't, you're going to lose your cert. Let me say a word about the currency. Your own weak and low credibility currency is equivalent to entry barriers. It favors everybody within the country that wants to keep those who are out of the country out. Now that doesn't mean that everything in the Eurozone works very well. In fact, if the Eurozone proceeds as it is, without structural changes in itself and with very low prices, it is not sustainable, in my humble view. However, that doesn't mean that for an economy like Greece, which is a small 10 million economy at the edge of Europe, the way to move forward is the way that some other economies have done, which is to go towards closing your borders, be afraid of foreign people and foreign capital and foreign ideas. That may work perhaps for larger economies. Even for them, I don't think it's going to work. Sorry. But certainly it's not going to work for Greece.
Can I add something?
Yes, please, Costa.
Yeah, so you know, there's a bit of confusion as to whether the euro is a good mechanism or not in a kind of a economies in equilibrium, let's say like France or Germany or, well, the UK used to be in equilibrium. But here, people who are talking about exiting the euro, they're talking it as a solution to the crisis as it is now. Now, our position is that the solution to the crisis is not just an overvalued currency, right, where you need a 10%, 15% adjustment. Right? That we are arguing, and I think well-founded, that the underlying structural problems are what are preventing Greece from growing. So if you don't correct that, you're never going to grow. Now, if you leave the euro now, you're going to have probably a collapse of the banking system. You're going to have a further reduction of the wealth of the Greeks in a major way, and you're going to add further policy instability because the Greek government will not be under the discipline of the Eurozone, which will again deter investment, which is kind of what Nikos was saying.
Very good. More questions from the floor? Yes, I'm going to take the man behind you there, and then we'll come this man here, and then...
Hello, everyone. My name is George Stephanopoulos. I have a question to all the panelists. Do you think that during a crisis there were moments that the creditors pushed the country and they weren't aligned among themselves just, you know, for the country good and benefit and the social, like, you know, basically good to turn around the country and collect, you know, the debt that the country owns them, rather than they have their own agendas and views?
Okay. So, Yanis, you'd like to answer that.
Sure, I'm happy to answer this. I'm happy to answer this because I was actually involved in a number of discussions directly with them. And it was, in fact, one of the topics I didn't cover because I think I was running out of time. What is the expectations? What are the expectations from our European partners and the institutions? First of all, I think that there is often for deep cultural reasons, and we can discuss afterwards over the drinks with George as to what the non-Greeks expect when they come and engage with us and what the Greeks do. And I think that what they would expect is for us to basically take a stand and acknowledge the problem and then engage, which we didn't do. And they will always, of course, depending on the particular actor, they will try to promote the interests for which they have been set up. So the IMF has a particular mandate, and it will try to promote it, and it will propose the solutions that it believes are appropriate for it. The other Eurozone countries that were putting their own resources on the line were going to try to minimize the amount of resources made available to us and assume very optimistic scenarios about the recovery. So, and when we gave them the opportunity to put all our assets ad hoc, because we claimed that we had assets of 100 billion, later reduced to 50 billion, of course they said, well, you know, you put them, you know, you contribute them. So they came to the discussion in a slightly different way than the IMF or indeed the ECB that paradoxically was in the Troika, but that was more interested to stabilize the system. So it's not the case that they had a particular sort of unified interest, that characterized all of them. Each one of them had their own reasons for being there. Ultimately, they were very much interested at the beginning for, you know, preserving the and mitigating the crisis and containing it. You know, they didn't want a wider banking crisis in the Eurozone, and that's very clear. But afterwards, as is now obvious with the discussions with the IMF that is proposing completely different solutions, each one sort of kept on going its own way. So we shouldn't really sort of describe it as a kind of conspiracy or them sort of pushing their interests down our throat. You know, each one of them did basically more or less what any independent sort of observer would have expected them to do. What didn't happen is we didn't engage at all on anything. We didn't have a view, and we simply accepted everything they said, assuming that somehow they would look after our own interest.
I see. Very interesting. This man here, we're going to come to you, and then we'll come to the man at the front row, and then we'll see who else we've got.
Hi, I'm Thanasis Bakos. I work for HM Treasury. So my question is for Kostas, probably, because I was very impressed with the idea of completely abolishing income tax and setting a 27% level for VAT. So I was trying to think any sort of negative side effects from this policy. I mean, you've addressed the issue of progressivity quite well, I thought, but I was wondering, this leaves the economy and the tax base quite vulnerable if there's an economic downturn and consumption collapses. So I was just wondering, is there any sort of good international examples of something like that happening? And do you think, to echo sort of Hugo's question, is that, would that be ever possible politically?
It's more Dimitris's suggestion, wasn't it? Oh, it's yours.
So it's it's, well, first of all, let me start backwards. It's kind of quasi happened. So the UK actually moved very much from an income tax to a consumption tax, both by Thatcher reducing a lot the marginal tax rates throughout the income distribution eventually, and increasing VAT quite a lot, and then by creating an unlimited tax deduction for pension savings up until Brown, which eventually the pre-Brexit Tory government started capping. So effectively, you could put as much of your income as you wanted in a pension fund, tax-free. That's basically a consumption tax, because it comes out on the other end when you retire, and it comes out as you consume, and basically that's when you pay. So it's another form of constructing an income tax. New Zealand, I think, has something kind of like that. Denmark has a very high and uniform VAT, although it's got a strong income tax as well. There was a lawyer at Columbia, used to be at Yale, Columbia University, called Gritz, and he was kind of discussing similar kind of ideas for the U.S. So after a talk, I asked him, why don't we do this in the U.S.? And he said, the problem with VAT is that the Republicans think it's a money-making machine and the Democrats think it's regressive. All you have to do is convince the Republicans that it's regressive and the Democrats that it's a money-making machine, and you'll have the reform.
Very good. This man's been waiting for a while. Take you.
I'm not impatient. I'm George Lemos. If I could preface my question with an entertaining aperçu, which is... a quote from a letter written by a famous...
Can you put the microphone closer?
Yes, a famous but casual visitor to Greece who wrote a letter to her mother on the 25th of March, old new style, 1880, and she said, among other things, he, and he's an incoming prime minister, is also understood to be most anxious to alter the practice now in force here, according to which every government employee, from post office clerks upwards, changes with the ministry. It seems that there are 2 million of uncollected taxes in Greece now, the arrears being largely due to the tax collectors being unable to employ any compulsion, the debtors simply threatening not to vote for the party which enforces payment. So that was on the 25th of March, 1880. I just wonder whether the authors, and perhaps Mr. Dixon, who asked a leading question, think that historians and even anthropologists might be able to contribute something to understanding the impediments to structural reform.
I think Dimitris should answer that, because in a sense I asked that question a bit.
I'll take it.
But you already answered my question. Dimitris was the only one of the three who didn't answer that question.
Well, okay. No, I'm happy. I mean, go ahead, and I'm happy to.
Think
about it.
Yeah, anthropologists deal with DNA and stuff, along with biologists and so on and so forth. Greece has been among the fastest-growing economies, along with Ireland, for several years. It is not a poor country. You have to think about the alignment of incentives. Now, where we are today, all the incentives, including those that have been imposed by the creditors, do not shift the country to a new productivity equilibrium. Basically, everything that has happened the last 8 or 9 years has stopped the bleeding, but without changing, in fact, the way economy works. That's my view. It has changed to a little bit. Now, it is, I think, imperative to understand the current situation, because the most important, perhaps, line that I heard today was by this man sitting to my left. Have we wasted the crisis? I don't think we have, because I don't think the crisis is over. Now, the question is, can you think of a new political economy that is drive you out? Here the glass is half full and half empty. It is half full because for the first time now since the beginning of the crisis, you actually have the entire spectrum of the entire political spectrum not disputing the overall direction. At the same time, the quality of the political dialogue, the quality of policies that are being implemented, and in fact, the way that governments interact with people, which is basically lying, and this has happened a lot during the last 10 years, actually cannot make you optimistic.
Mm. Well, we have a problem about that here too. So I'm going to take three questions. Two from there and one from Yorgos Milonakis at the front row. But we're going to take you as a batch because we're going to do batches now. So just please say very clearly your name and your question.
Hi, my name is Yanis Afanos, except from advising the UK government. One of the things I'm doing, I'm trying to promote investments in Greece. Okay. And the last year, I have seen too much interest, and actually tangible interest. So I guess they have seen something. And because it's enough with all this analysis of why we are here, everybody understands. I just want to understand why people are interested in investing in Greece. And I'm not talking about non-performing loans. And a quick comment on this is, I think Mr. Veda said that, is the first time that the whole political spectrum, with no exception, are talking about growth and they're not actually having discussions about memorandum or not. So the question is simple, why people are interested in investing now and why the interest is growing month by month.
Okay, growing investment, that's interesting. The man... Wasn't there another one there? You don't want to ask it.
Yeah, let's go to the ER. I'm here from Lotus School of Economics and Essex University. All the panelists, thank you very much for providing this book. It's quite in-depth in understanding the problem. Nevertheless, quite two things. One comment to you also, Mr. Dixon. First, about Professor McGeer that announced... his proportion in terms of 27 VAT. I understand completely the transitionary, the trajectory from income tax to consumption tax. I can see the points. Nevertheless, where I struggle to understand is by a recent article from Bloomberg saying that among a typical supermarket basket of the countries that they have under program, plus France and Italy, prices before VAT actually are quite competitive and sometimes in Greece are even cheaper. Nevertheless, after VAT becomes much more expensive, and this could totally deteriorate, you know, the purchasing power of a typical household, sometimes really undermining its essential goods for survival. So I struggle to understand why this uniform VAT and also increasing this. And the second point, it's also because I presented in a conference organized by Dutch Central Bank, and something that you said, who is to blame for? The political inclusion, it also comes from my understanding to syndicates. One example for this, it's about Uber drivers. I took a taxi to go from the area where the central Netherlands Bank to go to the airport of Amsterdam. And the taxi driver I took, it was an Uber, but actually all the taxi drivers are also Uber drivers. So it's a free, open profession, which actually we know that in London, it's quite, like in Greece, in many, many areas are quite strict, the markets there.
So what's your...
It's also the political, but also maybe the syndicates are quite strong.
Okay, and so...
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And final question for this round from Yorgos, say who you are.
Yorgos Milonakis, London Business School. So, first of all, thank you very, very much for this book. I think it is amazing that you put all this effort and energy in creating it, and very valuable as a source of debate. What I'd like to ask is, I understand the major actors that we have been looking so far is the lenders on the one hand, and now the conversation moves a bit more to the state in Greece as an actor. So I think this is a valuable, useful shift. But I'm wondering whether we might be, you know, what are the boundary conditions essentially in your argument? So if you look at some countries that could serve as examples or alternative ways of thinking about solving the problem. I can think of Lebanon or Israel, where the conditions for doing business, so the ranking of doing business is not high, and yet they have been able to attract capital inwards. Israel because of the Israeli diaspora, Lebanon because of the Lebanese diaspora. When Lebanon was falling apart as a country, the Lebanese brought the money in. When you look at Greece, the Greeks are taking, or were taking the money out. So I'm wondering whether that is an actor. And then another kind of actor might be potential inward investors. Look at China, for example, making Piraeus a major hub in terms of its expansion effort towards Europe. So I understand these are not solving the major issues that you are raising, which definitely need to be solved. But I'm wondering whether looking at these other kinds of actors might complement perhaps some of the solutions that you are talking about.
That's very interesting. So look, it seems to me that these bunch of questions, two of which were about investment, should also be taken with Ricardo's question, what actually of your reforms can be grasped to jumpstart investment? And then there was this question about the VAT and how it's going to push up prices. Perhaps you should, perhaps do you want to start?
Let me start quickly and kind of also to start taking a crack at Ricardo's questions. So I think we very much agree, and we take that stand kind of on the book, probably on a short part of the book, that a major challenge for the short run is fiscal policy, a major area of focus, let's say. So one thing is, I'm sure Ricardo kind of said all the right things, the commitment for fiscal stability, so the taxes are not going to rise for the next 10 years. And in fact, there is a precedent for that. Actually, Greece did that in the 1950s. So when it had this period, actually Greece grew quite fast in the 50s and the 60s. It was the second fastest growing country in Europe. So there was a constitutional amendment, essentially that for anybody who comes to invest, their taxes are going to be fixed for kind of a very long time. So maybe this cannot happen immediately, a constitutional amendment, but there could be a way to secure commitment to a stable path of corporate taxes. So. And has been very unstable, actually, the corporate taxes in the past 10 years or so. So I think, and more generally, that any kind of taxes should not grow from where they are, actually should go down, and then any shortfall should come from cutting expenditures. And somehow there should be some kind of something very mechanical and strict and hard there. So I think this would be a strong signal. What we said about the pension system, I think something along the lines of starting moving to a multi-pillar system is not from one day to the next, but getting the process moving, and this has happened in many countries, would also be a strong signal. And then we have a proposal in the book that is also concerns the justice system, which is fundamental for any kind of bringing in investment. We have some proposals that will take time to implement. But we also have a proposal that is for the short run, which is about to clear the backlog. So that's a very nice proposal about bringing in either retired judges or hire temporary judges for some period of time to do overtime to clear the backlog over the next 2 or 3 years. And somehow the book argues, the justice system chapter in the book argues, that this is a feasible idea. So I would think maybe a package of these three things could actually be something fairly quick to implement and have results.
Do either of the other authors want to address some of these investment questions? You know, the idea that there is already some growing interest by foreign investors, or Yorgos's question about the Greek diaspora being more actively wooed, as in Lebanon or Israel, or the other question about what can we do to get more of the Chinese? We can't address them all, but do you want to pick off one of those questions, either of the two of you? Maybe you, Nico, since you're actually there in Greece.
I guess when you're talking about the diaspora or money abroad, there are two dimensions. One is you're going somewhere for profit, okay? The other thing is the responsibility, in some sense, of the Greek business class, which is related to some political economy issues, and then you start to have naming names. So far, none of this has happened, and things in my book do not look all that good. Let's think about that there is still a country risk. If you take two identical firms, one is, let's forget Greece for a second, one in Spain and one in Germany, they would actually borrow at completely different rates. And this is not something that you can actually think that in a market that is supposed, this was not part of the plan, that the rates are going to be so different. What you can do, we have been talking about a number of fixes here and there. In the end of the day, if you don't have strong political leadership that is going to be determined to move you from point A to point B, all this in some sense is going to be in vain.
Mm. Okay, we're going to have one last round of questions. Okay, I'm going to take Simon, this man, and this man. These are the three I've seen, and that's going to be it, I'm afraid. Say who you are.
Simon Nixon, Wall Street Journal. I had a couple of sort of technical questions and one bigger question, if that's all right. Firstly, on the tax rates, I'm a little bit puzzled by the tax rates you displayed earlier. The IMF, during the crisis, kept circulating charts showing that Greece's degree of tax payments were the lowest, the participation in tax was the lowest in the Western world. Only 50% of Greeks actually paid income tax. And you're saying on your chart there that 70% would be exempt. So it's a sort of only an increase of 20%. Is that, and yet, so it seems to be that already 50% are not paying tax, and so, but you're going to go to a negative tax rate by introducing VAT. So I'm just trying to, I mean, our question there is, can you reconcile your numbers with the IMF numbers there?
Yeah.
The second question relates to something that wasn't discussed at all, and maybe it is in the book. But at the beginning of the Greek crisis, there was a huge amount of discussion about land reform and land registries. And this, at the beginning of the crisis, this was seen as one of the biggest issues. And you never hear anything about it at all anymore. A couple of years ago, I sat next to the Minister of the Environment at a dinner in Athens, and he was telling me that there are entire towns in Greece that officially don't exist because none of the properties were ever built legally or registered legally. So, I mean, is that an issue that's just gone away, or is that still mm-hmm. an issue? And then thirdly, and very briefly, my bigger question is Hugo's question asked in a different way, which is the question about political leadership. What does the panel think is there a risk that rather than going forwards in the direction that you have suggested here, what is the risk that Greece actually goes backwards when international pressure is removed? And again, Nikos said in his presentation, talked about education. Now, education seems to be was one area that should have been part of the program but wasn't. And as Nikos said, that's an area where actually Greece has gone backwards. As international pressure is removed, as Greece goes back to the capital markets, what is the risk actually that rather than going the direction you would like Greece to go, actually it goes backwards again?
Mm. Okay, that's all those interesting. I'm not sure we'll get to answer them all. But did you want to ask a question? No. There's the man behind. We'll make this the last question.
Hi, Paris Andrianopoulos.
Say your name again.
Paris Andrianopoulos.
Paris Andrianopoulos.
Greek, working in London.
Okay.
As many people do. The questions from the last gentleman actually are helpful to segue into my questions. One is about education of audience. You know, political leadership comes from voters. Voters are an audience. Has anybody thought about educating the audience by presenting things like this, but in a more digestible format, maybe on national television or on the internet? Mm-hmm. That's one proposal slash question. And the second one is, how worried are you about Greece's return to health if there is a global downturn coming? Thank you.
Okay, great. Well, those are good ones to end on. Do you want to start?
Yes.
Costas, so, I think if the key ones that we must answer are, is there a risk of going backwards when the pressure's off? And what happens if there's a global downturn, even though it looks like we're not in one at the moment, unless you're sitting in the UK?
You want me to skip VAT?
No. You do the VAT. Or do the tax thing, the 50% to the 70%, I think.
Yeah. So, okay, so first of all, the kind of calculation we do in the book are all revenue neutral. So we take the current system, the current compliance rates, and we ask if we don't change compliance rates for income tax, how could we restructure the system? Our restructuring was actually not only looking at the kind of fiscal situation now, but looking into the future. And we believe that a consumption tax has a number of advantages, such as encouraging savings, automatically broadening the tax base to all sorts of different types of income, getting tax evaders to pay tax because they have to the extent they consume in Greece, right? So that was key. And we also think that in the longer run, it's an easier system to have compliance for. First of all, we already had improvements in compliance in VAT because of credit cards. Secondly, as the economy grows, it grows to the formal sector, that complies. So it's not an immediate fiscal adjustment. And thirdly, it's easier to have a good audit system of the income tax if you're trying to chase the top quartile of the income distribution rather than trying and gather tax everywhere along the way with the small self-employed people that are around. But, you have to look at the fiscal problem at the same time as the longer run of the structure of the tax system. I just want to say one thing. You know, I was my co-authors asked me to say this. I will say it, and then Dimitris and Nikos will pick up the end of the question. At least I view Greece as the potential California of Europe, right? You know, think about it. It's got the weather, but that's, you know, we live in London, so we probably don't care about the weather. But it's kind of nice to live there. It's a relatively liberal place, right? It's a place where somebody who is used to living in a Western European country would mainly feel comfortable living with, and there've been, you know, great changes. It's a comfortable. So all the infrastructure is there. If we change entrepreneurship and make the country much more friendly to entrepreneurial activity, it could really be, in two words, the California of Europe.
Okay, fantastic. Dimitri, would you like to deal with one of the big questions?
Okay. So this question about Greece going backwards.
Yes.
I would like to maybe add a bit. Some things were said before, bits and pieces. So, okay, there is a risk of some of that happening. And actually, for example, Kostas touched upon his presentation about the labor market, that there is some pressure to reverse some labor market reforms. The thing that I would like to add to this discussion is that if Greece goes back seriously to many of these things, first, suppose it goes back, I mean, there will still be kind of monitoring and reviews by the creditors. It's not that Greece will be completely left on its own until it repays a big chunk of its debt. So, but suppose that even it, within the limited degrees of freedom it has, it goes back, it will be quite miserable if it stays in the euro, because it will really have kind of, with the rigidity of the current, kind of without the ability to devaluate the currency, it will be quite hard to grow. So this is the point about euro providing some discipline. So if governments cannot borrow their way out like if they did in the 80s or after the euro entry and generate growth that is just kind of debt-driven. So they have to find other ways if they want to achieve growth. They have to somehow, Syriza, for example, has set up a task force about attracting investment. And so they have to, maybe they don't show their love to investment all the time, but they're trying. So they have to find ways to generate growth, and there are not many, their borrowing will not do it anymore.
And Nico, would you like to answer the final question about what happens if there's a global downturn? What will happen to Greece?
There will be an economic downturn worldwide. We just don't know when. So, so you have to live through these challenges, and at the same time, you have to also recognize opportunities that arise from the completely new landscape in terms of technology and jobs. Just think about what were the three employment areas in Greece. It was public sector, it was retail trade, and it was construction. All three are gone. So unless the country really rediscovers itself, you're not going to create a single new job in the next 15 years. Simon, to your question, to your other question, there is a lot to be said, like Dimitris did, about the pressure continuing being on. And your question was, if Greece can go back, if the pressure is off. Allow me to add that if the wrong type of pressure continues to be on, there is even then a pressure, a risk of going. If the pressure is only on increased fiscal matters and ignoring all the, Mr. Dixon is going to say, political, economy, structural, then this equation is not going to work in the long run.
Well, now, on that happy note, no jobs being created for 15 years and the wrong sort of pressure. But there is, the whole book is there outside and is there available for you to buy. You're strongly encouraged to do so. And there is a reception afterwards. Would you like to repeat where it is?
Yes. It's going to be at the LSE's senior dining room, so which is not in this building, but it's in the main LSE building on Houghton Street. So the LSE's main entrance, you just go to the fifth floor, and there is the reception.
So a big round of applause to the authors and the discussants. Bravo.